Welcome to Diamond Profile by GCAL, Gem Certification and Assurance Lab. GCAL is excited and proud to welcome you to the launch of our brand new podcast series, Diamond Profile. With each upcoming episode, GCAL will bring to the industry real-time information from respected industry experts. In the unprecedented times that we are living through, no one individual or company has all the answers. In trying to figure out how to navigate these challenging times, GCAL will be reaching out so our industry can experience the power of sharing information. And now for your host, Angelo Palmieri.
I am your host, Angelo Palmieri, Chief Operating Officer of GCAL, and I am very excited to introduce two industry leaders for our second episode of the podcast. Ronnie Vanderlinden and Jeff Fisher, both seasoned veterans of the industry, will join us today to discuss the ongoing supply chain disruptions, viable diamond centers and the unique challenges they face, the key diamond mining companies, natural versus lab-grown, diamond exchanges, price lists, and much more. Ronnie Vanderlinden began his career in the diamond industry in the late 70s and is currently president of Diamex Inc., a diamond manufacturer and wholesaler. He has become deeply involved in all aspects of the industry by maintaining a number of top positions in national and global organizations. Ronnie is currently president of the DMIA, IDMA, and United States Jewelry Council, an umbrella organization of 16 U.S. associations. Formerly, he was chairman of the board of the New York Diamond Dealers Club, treasurer of the World Diamond Council, president of the 24 Karat Club, and board member of AGS and JVC. Jeff Fisher began his career in the early 70s and is currently president of Fisher Diamonds, Inc., a diamond manufacturer and wholesaler. In addition to heading his family business, Jeff plays a key role in industry leadership. He has served as a member of the board of GIA, chairman of the JVC, president and now honorary president of IDMA, president of the DMIA, and is a founder of the World Diamond Council. He also serves on the advisory board of the Diamond Development Initiative, whose mandate is to improve the living conditions of struggling diamond diggers in Africa and to help create acceptable standards for artisanal diamond mining. He is also a past president of the 24 Karat Club of New York and currently serves as chairman of the board. Welcome, Ronnie and Jeff.
Thank you.
So the first thing we want to talk about today is the supply chain disruption, especially in India, as it relates to production and export capacity. There also appears to be a disconnect between what suppliers are projecting for the season and what retailers are expecting. Can you provide an update, production prognosis for the rest of the year, and best advice for the industry to protect themselves?
Well, the disruption in India is certainly not unique to India. Supply chain is disrupted in so many industries all over the world. But because the diamond industry has become so dependent upon Indian manufacturing, it is, of course, having a profound effect. India very responsibly put a moratorium on import of rough following the shutdown in the spring and summer. And as a result, of course, the inventory in the pipeline continues to be whittled down and brought more closely into line with current demand. But there are spot shortages arising and more shortages anticipated. Now, just this past month, India jumped back into the rough market and bought very heavily, I believe to the tune of about $700 million. We hope that the responsible business practices continue to keep things in check. Otherwise, we're going to have a bouncing ball kind of a scenario where there'll be undersupply and then oversupply and going to have a non-constructive influence on price. So this month, hopefully, is just an indication that they're doing a quick catch up and there'll be more even production going forward.
So Jeffrey spelled it out quite succinctly here. Now, the good news is India, as he mentioned, has just recently made a nice size purchase of rough. The good news is that the factories are operating again. And the good news is that there's speculation that the holiday season may end up stronger than first predicted during COVID. This is all very good news. We just recently had our first virtual Diamond Congress ever last week. And there was one of our guest speakers was Mr. David Kelly from the Natural Diamond Council. David, when he spoke to everyone, when he spoke to all of us, he said that all indicators for the diamond industry, diamond and jewelry industry, I should say, are very positive for the holiday season. And in fact, out of all the luxury items, and usually we are either flatlining or, you know, on a negative situation, we are the one luxury item, the diamond and jewelry industry is the one luxury item that's seeing growth. And for him, he sees that this growth will continue, barring any unforeseen circumstances, obviously, throughout the fall into the holiday season. So it's very exciting. The other good news is that they're coming out with an ad campaign for the holidays that should help each and every single one of us during the retail holiday season, which is coming. India, from what we understand from close colleagues of ours, India is back on the rise. Though the COVID, as you mentioned, is moving up, the numbers are moving up, I'm not sure that the hospitalization is moving up. And that's a very good sign. And what's a really, really good sign is the fact that the factories are operating. And hopefully, as Jeffrey mentioned, we are seeing shortages. Hopefully the shortages won't be as terrible, obviously, as we're expecting for the holiday season.
Great. So just a few follow-ups on that. So obviously, as we you know, take in the news with the COVID cases in India steadily rising up to, you know, 100,000 daily cases per day, you're seeing on the ground that that may not be translating to hospitalizations, and that output capacity and factories are operating at higher levels today than they were 30, 60, 90 days ago?
Absolutely.
And Jeff, you had mentioned about the moratorium on rough purchases coming into COVID, and now that's kind of changing. How are they balancing that well with, you know, the shortages that are in the market, where they're prioritizing what rough needs to be purchased to procure the sizes and qualities which we are seeing shortages of?
They are doing their best to do that. Anybody who's familiar with diamond production, particularly quantity diamond production, knows that it is a shotgun approach. You aim for what you want to produce, but the amount of byproduct produced in the product is always substantial.
Sure.
And you can't build that up forever. So they're going to have to move that, and hopefully they'll do some smart strategic stock balancing.
It's not only that, if I may, you know, Jeffrey's right in that there's pieces. But, you know, today what's happened is people are realizing that everything doesn't have to be an HSI-1 or a GVS-2 or an ISI-1, that you have that range, you know, and the range is affordable. And most of the merchandise today, the way it's being produced and manufactured and made, each stone is just beautiful on its own rights today, as opposed to in past years, when we didn't have the technology that we have today.
Do you expect retailers to face shortages this year for the rosy projections of the Natural Diamond Council? Do you see a disconnect between what suppliers can produce and what retailers are expecting to sell?
Retailers, you know, that's a very broad category. And if we're going to talk about independent retailers, particularly smaller to middle independent retailers, they have the luxury of being able to play things closer to the vest. They don't have to have an enormous amount of lead time to prepare their needs. Of course, it's only professional to look ahead and not start stocking up in November for December. But the just-in-time ability to fill inventory is there for the smaller and medium-sized independents, whereas the large mass retailers need to anticipate their needs many months in advance and have their goods, you know, all geared up to be in the stores well in advance of the season. The majors are going to be confronted with much more of a challenge filling their wish lists where they see the most demand as opposed to the independents.
Yeah, I agree with Jeffrey. The point, you know, fact is that 4-grainers, carat stones, carat and below, 3-grainers, thirds. And so it looks as though there will be in short supply for at least the very moment. How much of that they're going to be able to ramp up production for, because that's the greatest amount of use, right, of sales. How much of that is going to be available during the holiday season remains to be seen.
So we focused the first part of the conversation as it relates to supply chain disruption on India. But as COVID was taking the world by storm this year, a lot of customers, at least of ours, and I'm sure worldwide, started thinking about diversifying their supply chain. And could they look at other diamond centers as possible cutting operations or cutting hubs for their product? You know, if we're looking back at March, April, May, the world looked very different than it does today, with a lot more unanswered questions than we know now. So can you just give us an update, what you see on the viability of some of these other diamond centers, Israel, Antwerp, Dubai, New York, China, Hong Kong? And, you know, does it seem like some cutting is now shifting from India that has been hit so hard by COVID?
Unfortunately, as we learned, Israel is in a shutdown for the next 3 weeks because of the increase of COVID. So with that being said, I mean, when we look at the world today, India is the primary manufacturing country by far. I mean, they're, Jeffrey, 90% plus minus of the world's production today. So when we look at the other areas that you're talking about, Dubai, there might be one or two factories in Dubai. Israel certainly has a few factories left. We've seen what's happened here in New York. Unfortunately, you know, I'm one of the guys left with one, but there aren't many factories left in New York. And I don't mean, unfortunately, that I'm left with one. Unfortunately, there aren't more factories in New York. You know, we've seen this shift into India over the last 20 years, which obviously creates the shortage that we have now, with the factories having shut down since March and really coming back up to operation this last month or so. Israel, on the positive side, and I can share this with you, I have a very close friend and colleague who, during all of this, had sent merchandise in because he didn't know what was going to happen in Israel to the office, and asked that if we can hold it here from Israel so that he could, you know, have merchandise here in case they need distribution. Well, interestingly enough, I shipped the merchandise back to him last week because of the shortages in Israel now. And the demands in Israel within the own community, he sold the bulk of the merchandise that was shipped back to him already, which is positive, because they're feeling good about what's going on and they're feeling good about the industry. You know, we look at things how they are right now and we say, oh my goodness, look at the horrors that we're going through. But if there's a takeaway from all of this, the industry has stabilized quite a bit over the last few months, which is, you know, it's great. It's great. Now we need to see production ramped up so that everybody can get their share of the, you know, of the wealth again, as they say. But I would venture to say that these other areas like Hong Kong, it's been hit. It's been hit. And, you know, we were supposed to have our World Diamond Congress there in November. And unfortunately, anybody flying to Hong Kong today will have to be quarantined for 2 weeks. So it wasn't possible. And ergo, we had the virtual Congress last week. So, you know, we're all hoping that these areas that are so important to the industry will, in the new year, be back and operating.
Speaking of Hong Kong, obviously recent events are that now that exports from Hong Kong must be labeled as made in China, which is a very recent new legislation passed by our government. Are you seeing that impacting the importance of Hong Kong in the gems and jewelry sector? And are items now that were not tariffed before, are they now being tariffed the way that products and exports from China are?
Hong Kong is a very active trading center. We're talking, you know, we have to divide it up into jewelry and loose diamonds. For loose diamonds, it's a very active trading center, not really a manufacturing center. The biggest impact that's happened to Hong Kong is the fall off in travel, which has caused tremendous reduction in tourism to Hong Kong and visitors to Hong Kong. And so the retail business is off dramatically. Trading is, you know, still going on with goods being shipped back and forth between the diamond centers, but it's more of a fall off in demand there.
Jeffrey's right. I mean, it's all being affected one way or another. It is interesting because during the COVID experience, where I was telling you, for instance, a colleague of mine was shipping his goods into the United States, the Indian community was shipping a lot of their merchandise into Hong Kong to have it freed up. I don't believe that as of yet, it is, you know, there's been an effect coming, you know, with the diamond and jewelry industry as things have been affected in China. So, you know, I really don't see it yet, and hopefully it won't happen because it's such an important center for all of us. Keep our fingers crossed.
Something you had mentioned before, Ronnie, about qualities and sizes and different shifts maybe this year in what's available. Do you see or do you project any diamond quality and size shifts as a result of the pandemic? How do you think price points will be impacted? You know, what are you seeing in diamond prices in terms of up, down? Are prices changing on certain sizes and qualities? So few different questions there. I think maybe the first one to start with is, did we see any quality shifts as a result of the pandemic, or maybe more as a result of supply availability?
Well, I think it's both, personally. Certainly because of the pandemic and the lack of manufacturing, as we spoke about with the SI merchandise. And so we've seen a quality shift into some of the better markets, VS1 and VS2s. Obviously, the SIs are very hot in the mid-range, very hot. But with that said, we've seen across the board, and I have seen this personally, Jeffrey would have to comment from his side, but I've seen that people are willing to make exceptions today when it comes to looking for a diamond. So if something doesn't fall into their specific range, they will look at other categories, be it, you know, the quality, obviously, the clarity or the color, or even the sizes today. Interestingly enough, what I have found, and I would need Jeffrey to chime in on this as well, 1-carat stones, 4-grainers, are extremely hot. The 5-grainers and those sizes that were incredibly hot at one point are a little bit softer than the caraters now. It was the other way. So yes, there's a shift in what the consumer or what the retailers are explaining to the consumer and possibly selling them, but it's all good. Because a diamond by any other name is still a diamond. And, you know, when you have a beautifully made, which we as manufacturers always say, when a stone is made, that brings, you know, as the consumer would say, that sparkle to the diamond, that brilliance, whether it's an SI quality or an internally flawless quality, to the eye, they're both stunning. So, and, you know, of course, you know, we've talked about this at length amongst our colleagues. You know, the extra money that certain people were receiving during COVID, the $600 and so on and so forth, seemed to help in the spending as well. So there's, you know, there's obviously a lot to it. There's a combination of you know, situations, and there's a combination of areas. I mean, where down south may be looking at one type of stone and north may be looking at another. But I do see that that across the board, things that were extremely quiet before COVID, some of the larger stones, some of your better stones, are selling as well, which is very exciting.
And what about diamond prices? Are you seeing changes in price?
Absolutely stable to going up.
Stable to up.
Stable to up is the way that I see it.
Across the board or
across
in certain categories?
Across the board. I don't see anything. Pre-COVID, prices in certain articles were very soft, especially, you know, in certain merchandise that we're all, that I'm in, gem merchandise and so on and so forth. And the reason it was soft, because it wasn't really moving. Today, it seems that diamonds are moving again across the board. So you have merchandise that is very stable. You know, prices haven't really gone up. And then you see on certain articles are commanding premiums today.
The items that are demand, that are in demand right now, focus of activity is, are definitely going up. And there's not really even that much price resistance. The items that are completely, we'll say, on the periphery or out of favor are not going down. They are, you know, holding their own. And that is a very healthy sign. Whereas before there was this divergence. Prices were going in two different directions. In the worst case scenarios, we have stability. And in the best cases, or if you're looking for the goods, it's not the best case, but there's price strength and escalating prices.
That's great. And do you see, is there any specific category where you really see strength in price, large fancies, large rounds, certain quality combinations?
Rounds are still the most popular shape. and sizes that are in focus are plus and minus 1 carat stones, and, you know, certainly up to 2 carat stones. But, you know, let's say the spotlight is on a 1 carat stone, and it spreads out from there.
Certainly certain ovals are very hot in demand.
That's probably the
air shapes.
Probably the hottest fancies.
Okay, so we are moving to a different topic. We're going to talk about laboratory grown diamonds versus natural diamonds. And we have a few questions on this topic, so I'll lay them out and then you can address them how you see fit. Do you expect the overall diamond marketplace to grow as a result of the entrance of laboratory grown diamonds? Or do you find that lab grown sales have been or will be at the expense of natural diamond sales? And with many site holders and De Beers now selling lab grown and every major laboratory grading them, how do you see natural and laboratory grown diamonds coexisting in the market in the years ahead?
I think they coexist very well now, whereas in the past they didn't. There were those out there that were, when it first came to the market, that were extremely resistant to it, and some that would say absolutely not. A lot of those that say absolutely not today are absolutely enjoying selling lab-grown diamonds. I do believe that you know, they will have their place in the market. What it will, you know, any effect that it may have on the natural will be for those that are making a decision for themselves. But I do believe that the natural market is here to stay. The natural market isn't going anywhere. You know, as one colleague said to me long ago, and this was from a diamond producer whose name I will leave out, all right, but everybody knows, it says eventually when the mines are depleted, we will need an alternative, all right? We talk about, you know, mines, if no new mines are found, another 20 years or 25 years of existence. The lab grown, you've seen, for instance, as you mentioned, De Beers get into it and they have their price point, anything. It's $800 a carat, end of story. We've seen the prices dramatically drop over the years. And as technology advances, and I always liken it to a mobile phone. You know, I did have a bag phone that I think I paid $6,000 for when it first came out. And then I had the Maxwell Smart Shoe phone that I paid $3,000 or $3,500. Then I had the StarTac, the bigger. And that went, you know, to 1,000. And then now we're wearing computers. We're wearing smartphones. We're literally wearing computers for that same $1,000 or less. As technology advances, the prices will drop. And as far as lab grown is concerned, as long as the contract labor is still there to produce them, that's a fixed cost. The moment that you're going to be able to put a diamond in one end of a machine and comes out the other end is polished, you'll see the prices drop as well, because then it's just producing one after another. Whereas natural diamonds are still natural diamonds. Their resale value, when you're a manufacturer, you're looking at every point. You need to make a gorgeous stone, but you're looking to save every point because that point is a lot of money. So I see the two absolutely coexisting. They will have their part and play their part in the diamond and jewelry world with people, and they will ultimately have a lot of fun with both.
I think what Ronnie was touching on is that until not all that long ago, the two different camps confronted each other very negatively. We all know that the natural diamond industry is a very conservative industry that's slow to embrace change and did not react particularly well to the advent of man-made product. At the same time, the man-made product was attacking the natural segment because they felt under attack themselves. It's not looking to point fingers or point blame now. What we're looking to acknowledge is that both segments of the industry have come to their senses, or at least have seemed to come to their senses, and hopefully it will stay that way. And I believe that as long as we are civil towards each other and present the best traits of our products instead of bashing each other with negatives, then there is enormous room for growth. And each segment can complement the other and help grow together.
Great. So as you mentioned, Ronnie, as you talked about where technology improves and price comes down, I would say it's very evident that the average carat size of a laboratory grown diamond that's sold in the market today is increasing. So are you seeing corresponding shifts in the natural market? You know, in other words, is the increase in size of lab-growns driving an interest in larger natural diamonds? And do you see or do you expect to see natural prices reacting at all to lab-grown sales or the lab-grown market? Or do you believe the markets and the pricing decisions completely independent of one another?
So I do see them. That's a great question. And I do see them as independent, no question about it. The fact is, as we mentioned earlier, that the prices of natural are stabilized and going up. The prices of lab-grown have actually, you know, they're stable. They're certainly not going to go up, and we'll see where they go from here. But again, you know, the two communities will coexist. They will coexist. And those that are buying and that have the means to buy natural will continue to buy natural. Those that want to buy lab grown will continue to buy the lab grown. But I do believe thoroughly that the natural industry is treading its own way now. We're going and, you know, we're continue to manufacture, we continue to sell, and we continue to promote the natural side. The lab-grown industry is doing the same. And quite frankly, when you look at it, and I think you mentioned earlier during this podcast that we look at some of the large manufacturers today that are actually doing both. They have separate companies for lab-grown and for the natural. The good news is the lab-grown over this difficult period, which is, you know, quite a bit less expensive, but is still cut like a diamond, like a natural diamond, kept some of these factories busy because it was affordable to do that and keep your staff employed. The good news is, as you heard earlier, and you heard Jeffrey say, India made quite the purchase last month of rough, and hopefully they will continue to make these purchases of rough, again, barring no unforeseen circumstances. So no, I think they will coexist. They'll run down the line together, and what will be. Difficult to say because the crystal ball is kind of acting funny these last few months, but hey, let's hope for the very best outcome for all of us.
Talking about the crystal ball, I have on my desk here, and of course there's no visual, but I'm holding up a Rosenthal paperweight in the shape of a polished diamond that's about 3.5 inches in diameter and probably weighs close to 0.5 pounds. And in an industry that is developing as rapidly as the man-made diamond industry or man-made diamond technology, we don't know what the future holds. It's kind of like science fiction. And there are a lot of people saying what will happen when they can produce 0.5 pound polished diamond. Science is going to find uses for those things. I don't know if the jewelry industry is going to find it or not. And probably the worst case scenario for the man-made diamond industry itself is if they do become paperweights. So they'll find purposes for them, or if there is no purpose, they won't produce them. But it's going to be interesting to see how that unfolds, because that will be a byproduct of the efficiency of making them for less and less money. Sure. And bigger and bigger.
I think what we're seeing now in the lab-grown space, aside from some of the site holders that had resisted but now have embraced it, is we're now starting to see companies that were purely established for government and scientific uses of laboratory-grown diamonds are now seeing that there's another market aside from spectrometers and lasers and various defense and government uses, and are now starting to dabble in the jewelry industry. So we're seeing a convergence, certainly in lab-grown production, with a lot of different and non-diamond players coming into the market. So let's shift gears quite a bit, and I'd just be interested on a few thoughts. As you guys know, De Beers and Botswana have a pending contract to agree on, which keeps Botswana at the center of the diamond market. Do you have thoughts on if a deal seems to be imminent, and do you expect to see any major changes in the way that De Beers operates going forward?
Good question. I really wouldn't be able to answer that, but if I had to bet, and I was a betting man, I'll bet on De Beers. De Beers signing an agreement with Botswana. I will bet that, you know, it'll be obviously to the benefit of both if something is being signed. But, you know, whether there are going to be changes, I do believe, given the current situation, and we know what's what's happened again over the last few months with the Indian community resisting buying rough for the large part, I do believe that we'll probably see throughout the producers' world, so all the miners out there, we'll probably see a shift in dynamics when it comes to the way they sell their diamonds. When? I don't know. I don't know. But we did hear Ira Thomas recommend that the producers need to change their system of selling. So we'll see. I really, you know, we're as anxious as anybody else out there waiting to hear what's going on between De Beers and Botswana. But as far as any insight, I think those discussions are kept really close.
If history is any indication, this is a dance that Botswana and De Beers go through each time that contract renewals come up. And each one is, obviously struggling for their best position. With each round, Botswana has more and more parity with De Beers and strength in its negotiating position. And the end result seems to always be the same. The dance ends in an embrace. And it is a marriage made in heaven because it works very well for both entities. Botswana has definitely benefited from the relationship with De Beers, as has De Beers, obviously.
So let's stay on the same topic, but change companies and countries. Let's talk about El Rosa. They have been pretty active as of late, at least in trade press, promoting fluorescence, talking about tracking and origin. You have any thoughts on El Rosa, the moves that they're making, and what the future holds for them?
I'm certainly excited about the fluorescence. I think it's time everybody learns that fluorescence isn't a negative in a diamond, and that can be looked at very positively. And especially now in the world where we are looking at some shortages in the supply line, well, here you go. You know, there are fluorescent stones out there, and it's another diamond for those that felt negative about fluorescence in a diamond to start feeling positive about it and start, you know, introducing it the proper way to the consumer. And it gives them, as lab grown has, it gives them another vehicle. Because prior to, I guess it was the late 90s when fluorescence became a thorn in everyone's side, it was, you know, extremely saleable in the South. It was extremely saleable abroad. And as we know, when you look at the ranges, JKL colors and so with fluorescence, they're stunning. They're stunning. But so are the Russian goods with fluorescence. So it is, for me, I'm excited. I am personally excited, and I would think my colleagues are as well. And I hope that the consumers and the retailers will be equally as excited that the truth about fluorescence is coming out. So let's hope. Let's hope for the best there as well.
We're all very hopeful and fully support what El Rosa is trying to do with the promotion of fluorescence, and hope that it works. It's logical. It's rational. Consumer research has proven that consumers in blind taste tests, so to speak, in blind visual testing, say that they identify that this diamond looks more beautiful than this one, and it turns out that it's a fluorescent one that they're choosing.
So now you guys will have to enlighten me, because this might be folklore passed along to me before my days in the industry. But I was told that fluorescence was in fact always a positive thing, right? Viewed positively and described as blue-white type diamonds, and that the Japanese rejected them in part because they discovered that many diamonds were being either overgraded or overrepresented because of this masking that the fluorescence would do of the diamond's color. So is that folklore, or is there some truth to that?
I believe that two things happened. One is, yes, in Asia, we don't know if it was Korea first or Japan first, but there were some scandals with misgrading of diamonds where fluorescence was being abused in the application of the color grades. And there's a kind of a herd psychology, herd consumer psychology involved, where everybody turned tail and ran away from something. Then, because this negative impression was cast over fluorescence, the large jewelry retailers, they shied away from fluorescent diamonds because it became difficult to explain to the consumer. And anything that's difficult to explain became a, we don't want it. And, you know, you could explain until you turn blue that it was a good thing, not a bad thing. And the answer we got was, yeah, but our sales associates don't know how to explain it. And we all know that in some of the larger companies, not all of the sales associates have the degree of training that we wish that they did. And they move them around from one department to another, so they're not diamond fluent. It'll be a great thing if we can turn that around.
There's so much folklore about it, about fluorescence, you know, so many rumors, so much lack of knowledge about, as Jeffrey was saying, explaining what fluorescence is in a diamond. There were, you know, people that thought that if a stone had fluorescence, that meant the material was weaker, that a diamond could get damaged because of fluorescence. And quite frankly, as
it's nonsense.
And it's absolute nonsense. And in fact, the one thing that it does do is, like I said, especially with the Russian material, is brighten up the stone. For whatever reason, it is a bright material. Now, there was a material with fluorescence that was considered over blue that came from the Premier mine mostly. And we used to say they're Premierish diamonds. Hmm. And those were just over blue stones that when you looked at it, you saw the sky blue in it.
Sure.
But, you know, and they exist, but they existed at a price. And there were those that were very cleverly built, designers built jewelry around that, the Premierish stones that looked very different and very stunning. So I think there's a lot of knowledge to be gained, especially with what Alrosa is doing and working with the number of laboratories out there in promoting fluorescent diamonds.
Do you distinguish from your own either personal preference or market preference between yellow fluorescence and blue fluorescence?
As one friend once told me, yellow fluorescence is so rare that you could always identify your stone. That's about the only distinction I make from it.
Do you have any insights or opinions that you can share on the new diamond trading platform, Get Diamonds? And this question comes as a result of the clear market implication of the misstep that Rappaport took in late March with decreasing diamond prices. Obviously, the competition in the world of diamond exchanges has really gained new life over the last 5 to 6 months. So do you have thoughts on that platform or other exchanges and what you're seeing in as your arsenal of tools that you use on a daily basis to sell diamonds?
Can we first start by responding to what you said about Martin Rappaport's misstep in March? There's been a great deal of misunderstanding outside the diamond trading world about what happened in March. The industry reacted very vocally and very negatively towards a downward price adjustment on the price list, more or less the day that we were being shut down. It was the timing of this price drop that the trade was reacting to, not the fact that the prices were lowered, not the fact that it did or did not reflect trends in the marketplace up to that point in time. It reflected a lack of what the trade thought was any kind of a sensible action at the moment of the shutdown. If it was a correction of inaction or mistakes made in the weeks or months prior, well, that responsibility doesn't fall on the trade. It was a misstep in its timing. And it did turn out in retrospect to be unnecessary because the anticipated drop in prices upon the market reopening did not occur. I just want to make it clear because a lot of people said, sure, the market's upset. He lowered prices. That's not what it was. Now that I've gone off my tangent, you should rephrase the question so we can go back to the other parts of your question.
Sure. And to be clear, you know, it was a market implied misstep, certainly from the exodus that we saw from the platform. So whether right, wrong, correct, incorrect, the market viewed it as such, and many people took their diamonds to other platforms. So let's go to the question from this. Do you have insights on the new diamond trading platform, Get Diamonds? And now that competition for diamond exchanges has really gained new life as a result of this, do you see any of them taking the lead? Are you now diversified and using many platforms? Are traders using a lot of different platforms now versus one or two that might have been pre-COVID?
I think that most of us are using more platforms than we were using beforehand. I think that competition has been a good thing. It will force everybody to raise their game. Dealers are free to use and should use whichever and how many ever platforms they want to use. And time is going to tell how that's going to shake out.
And that's exactly right. People will have a choice. There are a number of platforms out there, from Uni to Get to Market to Rappaport, IDEX. And I believe that the majority of those listing today are probably listing on all the platforms. And whatever decision is going to be made is going to be at a corporate level where they find their, you know, they find the best use. And that's what will happen. I mean, it's not up to any one person. It's up to, when I say any one organization, sorry, it's up to the individual. It's up to the corporation, and everybody will make the right business choice for themselves. And Jeffrey just, you know, as he does always, put it so eloquently, you know, with what had transpired back in March, you know, just things were difficult and things had come to a standstill on that March 20th. So people reacted with emotion, which diamond dealers tend to do because they are so passionate in their businesses. And as a result, you know, there were a number of weeks of those of us that were just listening to, like anyone else, listening to the noise around us and you know, what people were feeling. The good news is we also have very short memories, it seems. So we're looking forward now. We're not looking backwards. And again, whatever platform one chooses, that platform is there.
Great. So related to the diamond exchanges, one of the challenges was about the price list that was in dispute. Do we see new price lists coming into the market? Any price lists in specific that you want to talk about, or how you see that playing a role?
Well, if we had our way, we'd like to forget all the price lists, price guides out there. But there was as of last week, an announcement made by Uni and IDEX that they have a price list that they've introduced to the industry and would like the industry to take a close look at and decide whether they will use it or not. It seems to me that they've done some webinars themselves. I believe they're going to be hosting another one. It's very transparent, and they've gone through an explanation of how they gather their pricing information, and time will tell. It's exciting that there's another list. And again, as with the platforms, people will make their choices.
Jeff, when we turn to you, I'm not as familiar with this new price list, but does this new price list appear to be of similar mindset where you're going to need to discount from it, or is it a more realistic market price listed?
The market has come to operate very well under a benchmark system where the list itself reflects what we refer to as a high asking price, a range in which presumably any willing seller would sell. And then there's room for negotiation and discounting below that. And this new list will follow the same pattern or the same philosophy. The biggest shortcoming of the existing price list, we'll say the predominant price list in the industry, is simply that it is not transparent and is totally dependent upon the judgment of an individual. And although the individual says it's not the case, it is personified by that individual and the message is communicated by that individual. All responsibility and decision-making is taken by that by that individual. And we don't know of any other industry that is dependent upon this sole judgment of one individual. And it doesn't matter how responsible or dedicated or how positive it may be approached, it's not responsible on the part of the industry to allow themselves to be put in the hands of a single individual. And that's just something that's desperately in need of repair.
So guys, in closing, we've covered a lot of topics today, but do you have any final remarks about the state of the diamond industry you'd like to share, forward-looking thoughts on the season and beyond, or anything retrospectively looking back at this year of great challenges that you want to address before we close out?
Well, I don't want to look back. I really don't want to look back because, as we know, January, February were slow to start. March, unfortunately, brought us COVID. But looking forward, I'm excited because, again, barring any unforeseen circumstances, we're looking forward to a reasonably good holiday season, which is exciting. I believe that as we have through many, many other crises facing our industry, we've come out of it stronger. And I do believe we've learned a lot moving forward here. We'll come out of this in a different way. There's no question that we'll be operating our businesses differently today than we had yesterday, and certainly we'll be operating differently in the future. But as long as, and this is something we discussed during our Congress, Jeffrey and I discuss all the time, as long as we work together as an industry, not as individuals, we'll come out of this pretty strong. And we have a great product that there is that desire for, as has been proven during this pandemic, where again, we heard David Kelly say, where other flat luxury items are flatlined, we have a luxury item that saw growth. We saw engagements happening, we saw gifts happening, and that's what our industry is about. That's what the diamond and jewelry industry is all about. It's about the love. It's the love for one another, and it's the love for our industry. So the only thing I can say to everybody is stay safe, stay healthy, and wishing everybody really a successful holiday season.
Ronnie, you put it beautifully. The diamond industry thus far has come through all of this horrible turmoil around us with our trademark resilience. And we're approaching the future with our trademark optimism and believe that we have a great season and a great future ahead of us. That's the only way you come to work every morning.
Well, guys, thank you so much for your time. Your insight and analysis is extremely important, and we are excited to share it with the industry. I wish you guys nothing but health and safety and success for the rest of 20. Also, a happy, very happy new year. And again, we really appreciate your time, and thank you so much.
Best to you and all your listeners.
Thanks very much for spending time with GCAL today. We hope you'll join us again on Diamond Profile.